valley, and how he'd removed the cubes of all those patients on the Zeppelin. "She's scared," Kara translated to Rusev. "She doesn't want you to."
"We'll risk infection if we leave it as is. There are antibodies that activate when neural connectivity is operational. She's lost too much blood already."
Kara looked down and saw it was dripping off the gurney and pooling on the floor. She felt sick, dizzy. What was it like when Lydia had used the overrider on her? Issa was fading fast.
"Let me die. We're all as good as dead otherwise," she responded.
The words slurred together.
"What the hell is she saying?" Nicola demanded.
Kara fought through the nausea creeping up on her, the edges of her vision going fuzzy, the heaviness of her head. She didn't know what was right, save the girl or heed her warning.
"Stop," she blurted out, her eyes never leaving the WFC girls.
She might have been paranoid, confused. How could they be tracked with their cubes off? But then again, she might be right.
The second medic huffed. "We can't stop. She'll..." "The patient said she has seizures," Kara lied, taking her eyes off the girl to lock them with Nicola's.
She remembered vaguely that Lydia had researched the cube's effects on people with epileptic conditions.
"She said you need to know. If you resuscitate the cube now, it could trigger a fatal seizure."
Nicola and the other two medics exchanged a look. One of them muttered, "She might not be able to handle the narrow electricity." Finally, Nicola nodded.
"We have to disable it, then."
"You mean break it?" one of the attendees said, his eyes glassy. "It could kill her."
"It might," Nicola said. "But we know she'll die for certain if she has a seizure. She won't survive with the cube in place as is."
What had Kara done? The medic gave in. He took a pair of delicate pliers to Issa's neck and simply snapped her cube in two. It was much cruder than Kara had thought it would be.
"That's it, then?" Kara asked softly.
"That's it. The cube will never be functional again. Just a useless scrap of biotech lodged in her neck," the medic said, shaking his head as he cleaned the wound.
Issa's eyes fluttered closed, and Kara wondered if she would die now, and whether it would be her fault. Another life added to the list of her losses. But the Rayton girl did not die. Her wound had been sewn up, but she'd been hideously bruised. The stitches showed shiny and black against her dark skin. She was one of those girls who looked pretty when they slept. Her high, angled cheekbones looked dramatic, and she had a natural pout to her lips. Kara curled up in a chair pulled up next to Issa's cot as the girl lay unconscious, and waited for her to wake up. Sitting in the darkness, she stayed very still as the pulsing in her head quieted. The pain aching up her arms and legs dulled. She was lost in her own fog of grief and shock. Issa's surgery reminded her of her own procedure. Lydia had overwritten her memories. Her past, the Jocelyn of her, was as good as gone. Whiteness closed in on her vision, like the foam of a wave crashing over her. Sometimes it felt like losing the memories from her other life was nothing compared to being lied to. Kara had thought Lydia was her mother. When she'd spent all those late nights in the lab, when she'd come home absent-minded, absorbed in her work, when Kara had to figure out dinner for herself without so much as a call, Kara thought that maybe she'd fallen short somehow. That, if she had turned out different, Lydia would be more maternal. Available like other moms were. And, if there wasn't that to think about, there was everything else right here and right now. Alyosha had left her. She was flat out of meds and using a piss-poor substitute of warpers that would only get her so far. Rallier, and whatever waited for her there, still felt an impossible distance away. It was like there was this great abyss between the life she had lived so far and the life she should have lived, and the sister she should have known, who was now, at this very moment, sitting on the throne of Kalu. Kara had nothing. Nothing but an unconscious stranger, this WFC soldier who had risked her own life, to make sure they were okay. Hours passed. She drifted in and out of sleep, thinking of Loris. Wading into water so cold, her feet would go numb. Smooth, slippery stones under her feet. A dense forest that she could disappear into. And the salt, weighing down the air, hovering in the fog. In Loris, there would be no running, no training, no worrying about her next move or her face changing. Kara could practically feel the cold air, the need to fold her arms over her chest as it slipped through the wool of her sweater. She looked down and found something in the moss, her coin, her family coin. And suddenly, it didn't feel so safe or remote, and the sound of the birds chirping and the ocean roaring in the distance stopped. That old life would follow her everywhere. Then she heard a cough. Kara opened her eyes to see Issa staring up at the ceiling. The rusty coin was in the palm of Kara's hand. When Issa coughed again, Kara pocketed it and went to her side. Are you okay? It was a lame thing to say, but she couldn't think of anything better. Issa's eyes got big. All she said was,
Is it dead?
Dead? She asked, then realized that Issa was talking about her cube. A shiver ran over Kara's arms, all the way to the base of her neck. Everyone knew that a cube needed an organic counterpart to function, to live as Issa had implied. But she'd never thought of it as a living thing. It creeped her out a little, but she answered,
Yeah, it's out. Dead.
Someone's been hacking them. Cubes.
Issa spoke in a hoarse voice, like it hurt to talk.
Even when they're off. It's why I needed it to die.
Her eyes were glazed over, and Kara looked at her IV feed. She'd been given a healthy dose of painkillers.
How? Kara asked. How are they hacking them?
The other staff might have advised Kara not to engage. Issa sounded dazed. Hi.
But Kara felt the gravity in her words, because she knew what Issa said was possible.
After everything she'd learned of Nero, of her mother, of their biological experiments with the cube, Issa didn't surprise her at all. She'd been paranoid enough herself to keep her own cube off even before entering the frontline physician's craft, where it was required to stay offline. You weren't supposed to be in danger so long as it was turned off.
Issa shook her head. Beads of sweat formed on her temples. She looked like she was in a fever dream.
The update.
Kara went cold. She thought of what she'd learned from Pavel's Overrider research. The Overrider could be used on the public if their cubes were available via the same network at the same time. She rummaged for a small towel in a nearby cabinet and took deep breaths so she could stop trembling. Once she felt composed, she turned and held it to Issa's face as her wild eyes skittered around the room.
What about the update? Kara asked.
She felt a seed of guilt pressing the girl for information while she was half conscious.
But it was bigger than her. It was bigger than all of them.
Dangerous, Issa said. Then shuddered. Our job on Naufruma was supposed to be quick and easy. Minimal casualties. I'm a medic. It's not like soldiering is my specialty or anything. We were just supposed to drop an M-bomb, evacuate the camps, and get the hell out. But I pushed forward. I didn't follow rank.
She looked up at the ceiling. Kara was losing her again.
The update. The update.
What are you saying? Kara was desperate to keep her talking.
That I'm the reason half my unit is dead.
Issa laughed, and her face, so stern and so wild at turns, was now lit up with a flash of vulnerability.
There was someone I wanted to kill.
Kara sucked in a breath, bitter and sharp in her lungs. Issa closed her eyes.
You think I'm evil?
No. Not at all, Kara said honestly. War is about everyone trying to settle a score. They fell into a silence, but Kara couldn't let it end there, when it was so clear Issa wanted to keep talking, to be absolved. She took Issa's face in her hands and angled her gently, so now they were eye to eye.
What about the update?
Kara urged again softly. She felt like a predator, pumping this girl for information. But she craved the truth, any version of it she could get. She wanted to turn everything and everyone inside out, because she thought she'd known Allie, and he'd left. She thought she'd known Lydia, but she'd lied. And she thought she knew herself. But every memory, every aspect of her identity she thought to be true was diametrically opposed to the princess she actually was. The only thing she had left was this overrider.
The update. It's supposed to prime people for something, make their cubes more easily hackable. It's why we dropped the M-bomb, to stop the updates. And if I kept my cube in, I was afraid they would see everything. The only way to be sure was to gouge it out. But you wouldn't have survived.
Kara thought of the people on the Zeppelin, vacant, drawing triangles over and over again.
Or if you did, it wouldn't have been a life worth living. I know that. I wasn't thinking straight. But at the time, a ravaging felt safer than compromising everyone here.
Kara's skin prickled at the mention of a ravaging. It's what Allie had called it. It had been hinted at in Vaudhan's teachings.
But you came, and instead, they broke it, Issa said. Here I am.
She looked down at her hands like she had just realized. Here she was. Her face crumpled like she might cry.
You made them do that for me. I'm alive because of you.
All Kara had done was lie on the spot, out of instinct, a thing she was good at, a way to fill in the blanks for a history that had been wiped. But she felt wholly unprepared for crying. She'd seen Lydia cry only once, and that was right before she died, when she admitted she'd lied to Kara for as long as she could remember.
Don't cry.
Kara forced her voice to sound light as she pulled the towel away and refolded it for no reason. She pressed it back to Issa's head. Gently, she had to remind herself.
You're safe now.
They fell into a silence after Kara whispered to her to say she had seizures, if asked. Issa looked at her quizzically, but didn't press her on it. She was probably delirious. And anyway, what more was there to say? Kara blotted and redressed her wound, and eventually, Issa fell back asleep. But she couldn't get Issa's story out of her head. Was the update linked to the overrider? The timing seemed convenient. She thought of Lydia then, the woman who had thought logically, critically, who always had the same refrain. There are no coincidences.
The horror of it all. The scope and the trespass of it
finally sunk in. Karen knew she had to destroy the overrider, that it was critical to get it before it fell into the wrong hands. But she couldn't help but let her mind wander, wondering if such a thing could be used for good, and if it could free instead of enslave. What if she could use the overrider to erase Jocelyn to An. She wondered, for the briefest of seconds, if Allie was right when he'd pretty much called her a coward. But how could she be Jocelyn when her heart and mind were empty of that identity? It used to make her jealous that there was only a void where everyone else could pull from a wealth of high-def memories. The best she could do was snatch at shadows of her old life. They were ominous, dark, quiet things that lurked in the back of her mind. They were intense sensations, like the remnants of a dream. And always that nightmare, or the memory, a free-falling in the dark, plummeting down as she clawed at nothing, the wind stealing her voice. All that was left of Jocelyn was in her biology, clamoring to etch itself onto her features. Kara touched her chin. DNA suppressants were temporary. And if they were hard to get now, she couldn't imagine what it would be like once the galaxy notched up to all-out war. She'd never be able to stop herself from changing back. Not for good. There would be no end to that constant fear that someone would see Jocelyn Ta'an. She would always be on the run, living one long, drawn-out lie. She would never be free. Unless she could change everyone else so they didn't remember her face at all. Erase Jocelyn Ta'an permanently, from everyone's minds, all at once. She recalled the official collusion memo addressed to her father, the last emperor, which Pavel had shown her while they were spying on the internment camp. The memory of the Great War itself, to be erased from the collective memory, for the good of the people and advancement of the galaxy. The emperor had wanted to erase the Great War from memory, to heal the galaxy and the political divide the war had caused. As horrifying as that kind of power was, he'd had noble reasons, hadn't he? And then she remembered the last thing Allie had said to her, that if you didn't want to live a lie, it was up to you to change the truth. The idea, the scale of it, made the room swim in front of her eyes. If Kara did use the overrider, she would destroy it immediately afterward. The world didn't need Jocelyn anyway. It had Rhiannon, who'd survived an assassination attempt and clawed her way back to the capital to take on an unruly opposition. It was likely her sister would be better off without her, too. Never mind that she'd asked Jocelyn to return to Kalu. Rhiannon would be better off without some prodigal sister to challenge her legitimacy to the throne and undermine her in the eyes and hearts of the public. Jocelyn Ta'an was as good as a ghost. And now, Kara would soon have the means to make sure no one remembered her. Chapter 9. Rhiannon. As she made her way to Dalin's quarters, Rhi tried to swallow down the taste of ash. It was as if the two words she'd uttered had singed her tongue. I accept. She'd just officially agreed to ally with the man who'd killed her family, who represented everything she hated. His vanity, his tendency to suddenly care whenever he was in front of the camera. And the worst part was that he knew all along she'd say yes. She needed him. She also knew Dalin would be furious. But he'd come to understand. He had to. Rhi might have come off as moody and unpolished on the Hollows, eager to avoid interviews, generally unlikable, just as Nero had implied. Fine. But she cared about things that mattered. She didn't want the war to continue. Too many people had died in vain. Nero had doubled down. Not only did the Uniforce remain in Naufruma, but now there had been 3 fresh attacks on neutral territories across the galaxy. Everything was spinning headlong into chaos and violence, and she could not sit back and let it happen. She had to stop it. But she didn't know how. Not with the people of Kalu demanding retribution for what they saw as an attack on neutral ground. Not with Fontis arming for retaliation. It was a massive undertaking, and she simply couldn't do it alone. She needed Nero's endorsement. She needed those who followed him to follow her, too. And Nero had already agreed to meet with the United Planets and lay out the terms for a ceasefire, which seemed remarkable to her. A huge sign of progress. But now Dalin was avoiding her, and she needed his help to include the Fontisians. Showing the galaxy that Fontisians wanted peace too was important. Dalin had turned the east wing of the palace into makeshift barracks, where he slept with dozens of other Fontisian fighters. But the palace was enormous. The summer palace on Naufruma was hardly a tenth of the size of this one. And around every corner, a piece of her past opened up. She'd slowly been rediscovering pieces of her childhood, new and old blending together in her consciousness as she managed the organic memories that floated up to the surface, immersive, almost suffocating.
Empress.
Ree jumped. She spun around on the cool marble floor to face Lana. Today, she wore her hair in the style of an ancient Fontisian warrior, half up in a dozen braids, intricately coiled and tucked.
I'd rather you not sneak up on me, Ree said testily.
She didn't like how she felt in Lana's presence. Nervous, as if Lana was evaluating her.
I'd rather not come to fetch you, but we don't all get what we want.
She put her hands on her narrow hips.
I'm not a thing to be fetched, Ree said.
An immediate knee-jerk reaction when, in truth, she was relieved. This was Dalin's way of summoning her, which meant he was talking to her again.
He just expects me to come at his command?
He expects nothing, Lana said. We're leaving as soon as he gathers his things. I thought you'd want to say goodbye.
Wait, what?
Ree's heart started pattering hard in her chest. She thought for a second she'd misheard.
What do you mean, leaving?
He can't answer if you haven't asked.
Ree's confusion and anger were kinetic. The faster she moved, the more intensely she felt them. Lana led her to the barracks, where she saw Dalin's things packed neatly beside him as he sharpened his blade on a whetstone. His blonde hair, shoulder length, fell in an arc, obscuring his face from her. Ree's stomach sank. Dalin had no flair for drama. He'd packed. He really was planning to leave.
You can't do this, she blurted out. She wished she could think up some eloquent insult or a dressing down that would humiliate him into reconsidering.
But all she could think was, this can't be goodbye.
She felt her heart cracking open.
Look, she said, striving to control her voice. I know you don't approve of working with Nero.
I don't approve? He crouched over the whetstone but would not look up. As if I could approve a union so insidious. As if you'd be willing to listen.
You're the one who's not willing to listen!
He looked up. His eyes felt like fire on her skin. She stared back, holding his gaze. But it was hard to breathe, hard to swallow. This is not a mere disagreement, he said. This is a fundamental rift. He held the blade up to the light, examined it, and seemingly satisfied, sheathed it. That man is an abomination.
How could he not see? She had to entertain Nero's proposition. Otherwise, she might as well declare an all-out war against him and risk alienating his supporters further, alienating those whom he had pressed under his thumb, alienating everyone.
You don't think I know that? I'm not so stupid or so young that I can't see through his plan, but this is politics. I'm Empress of the Collusion Territories, public enemy number one in the eyes of every other government. Kalu's loyalty is slowly being stolen by that very abomination you speak of.
a Holovision star with a pretty face, of all people. And Joss is somewhere out there, hidden away, when her real life is here waiting for her.
Rhee's throat seized at the thought of her older sister.
Besides, it's a temporary alliance.
You can't temporarily corrupt your soul.
I don't have any other choice, and you know it.
Her anger flared.
You're being stubborn for the sake of it. You self-righteous fanatical.
Watch yourself, Empress, Lana said. Don't say anything you'll regret.
Rhee took a deep breath. Rhee started. Lana was right.
Dallin, we want the same thing. Peace. Too many lives are being risked.
He let out a hollow laugh that surprised her, chilled her even. It might have been the first time she'd heard him laugh. Lives must be risked in the name of what's right. We must determine to take the most difficult path, if it is the righteous one.
Don't throw your scripture in my face. You're just like everyone else. You don't think I'm capable of knowing what's best for my people. You follow your elder on faith, yet he keeps you in the dark.
I don't understand, he said. What are we actually talking about?
Rhee bit her lip. Your elder. He told me as much. There are things you know and things you don't know you know.
She still didn't understand what Elder Eskoff had meant when he spoke those words back in Arroway. But now the words seemed alive with meaning.
You've misunderstood.
Dallin's blonde hair fell across his eyes again, and he pushed it behind one of his pointy ears.
Those words are a meditation on faith and trust in the word of Vodhun.
She'd never seen him wear his irritation so plainly, and it made her feel all the more humiliated. Some empress she was, simpering and begging. She could barely stand herself.
Your faith, Rhee said. Your blind faith. It keeps you trapped. So bound in this idea of right and wrong that you can't even look up and see the world for what it is.
Could we not say the same thing about your brand of faith? He said. What is your Mata'an Cirilli, Empress?
Like most in the galaxy, Dallin knew it was an everyday greeting. But he knew, too, the intimacy of it, its deeper meaning, the pledge to be your highest self. Honor, bravery, loyalty. Had she betrayed these very ideals? Dallin looked at her, and Rhee found her answer in the disappointed look in his eyes. He shouldered his belongings.
You're wrong to leave.
I was wrong to hold you to your highest self, he said, as he made his way toward the door.
She suppressed a shiver at his words. The hope and disappointment in them left her shaken. She wanted to be the leader he spoke of, the leader he imagined. But she wasn't. Not yet, anyway.
Go then, she called. I don't need you. I need a partner who will help me end this mess of a war, not a fanatic whose scripture is so far up his ass he can't see the reality. The reality is that we need to be strategic.
With respect, Empress,
Dallin said, spinning around.
Nero isn't just going to acquiesce.
You think he's willing to pull troops out of these territories without some big trade-off that benefits him? There's no one coming to his senses or rising to the occasion. He's toxic. His promises are a trap, and I thought you would do better than believe him.
What if I told you he was after some sort of powerful cube tech?
She shifted her weight between her feet.
He said as much on Hool, that he was seeking a tech he wanted to change and alter a person's memories.
Even if that's true, aligning yourself with him will not get you closer to the truth.
Ancestors, listen to yourself. Isn't this all because he turned on your cube?
She fired back. She was desperate now. Without him, she had no allies outside of the palace. Nero had made sure of it.
Because your precious vow to the Order was broken? There are more important things than your faith, she reminded him.
There are lives at stake, and I fear we will lose more every day that we hesitate. She was trying so hard to strike out, to find the thing that would make him react, make him stay. And yet still, Dalin gave her a look that was so icy, it nearly froze her lungs.
You think I don't feel fear?
He asked.
Because I, too, fear. For Kalu. For all of us.
His voice stabbed into her, nearly taking her down. But his face was impassive again, its sharp profile cutting a jagged silhouette. Panic hit her then, an ocean of it. Surely he was right about Nero, but the only way to secure peace was to work with him, even if it meant navigating a labyrinth of lies. Why couldn't Dalin see that? If she couldn't keep the loyalty of her last friend, how could she earn it from her people? She would be lost without Dalin. She'd ditched him on the Zeppelin, and yet he'd still found her again, still stood by her. But now she'd gone too far. She loathed to admit it, even in her most private thoughts. But it was true. She needed him, precisely because he was so unbending. He was the moral compass she leaned on in this directionless world she'd woken up to.
I must follow my own path, and you yours, Dalin said as he walked through the threshold. I cannot do business with a demagogue.
So that's it? Rhi asked, steadying her voice. She wished more than anything he would stomp and throw things, spit a colorful stream of Fontizian curses. Or that he would sulk, or cry, or grab her shoulders and shake her, or anything. She wished he'd show what he really felt. Not just what his moral instincts were, but what he held in his heart. She needed to know that he didn't hate her. In a short time, he had become the person whose opinion mattered most to her. He turned away from her without a word, and Lana moved to follow him. Rhi didn't know what impulse overtook her. She just couldn't stand to see him go. Wouldn't. She had to have one last word. One last glance. Some sign that he cared. That he hadn't completely given up on her. Without thinking, she pulled Vayrin's knife from the belt where it now sat, always. Even when she slept, nestled tight against her hip.
If you're no longer my friend, she gasped out, that makes you my enemy.
It had come to this, threatening the boy who'd saved her life, with the tip of the knife Vayrin had almost used to kill her. She could barely hold back tears.
This is not the solution, Dalin said quietly. My feud is not with you.
Hope flared in her again for a brief second.
If I'm to stay by your side, you know what I require.
He was giving her an ultimatum. He wanted her to break her truce with Nero. Her heart fluttered. She could still undo this. But then, she thought of why she'd done what she'd done. She thought of the series of bombings following what happened on Now Fruma. She thought of Julian. She thought of Joss, out there somewhere in the galaxy waiting for her, possibly in danger. She shook her head. Dalin had to do what he felt was right, just as she had to do what she felt was right. He sighed, his eyes soft.
Don't leave,
Rhi felt herself begging, even though she hadn't lowered the knife.
You're the one who brought me here. You fought for me.
You believed in me.
You were uncompromising then.
He said it as if it were a lifetime ago.
I was not yet in charge of an empire, she said.
But she knew it would do no good.
Where will you go? What will you do?
He tilted his head and stared down at her, as if he were already seeing her from far away. Kill him, of course.
They'll blame me if you do.
Already thinking about how it will look, Dalin said, with infinite sadness.
He reached out and gently pushed the knife away, She let it drop. It clattered to the floor, and she felt everything in her fall with it. You'll make a fine politician yet. She blinked hard, turning away so he wouldn't see her cry. You won't be alone, he said gentler now. Lana will stay with you. The order will stay with you.
Excuse me?
Lana obviously hadn't expected this. He didn't answer. He merely lifted a hand in farewell, and then turned and slipped out of the room. Rhee willed herself not to run after him. But after a minute, she couldn't stand it. She ran to the balcony.
You're not to get close to any windows, Lana reminded her coldly.
Rhee ignored the warning and stood out on the balcony, watching for a last glimpse of him.
Empress, Lana tried again.
Rhee stood her ground, her chin up as she waited. Perhaps he would turn around and come back. He'd call up to tell her he couldn't leave, that he cared, that he believed in her still. But then she heard the rattle of a gate from the east side of the palace and realized he'd never leave out the front door. There were other exits, a dozen. Rhee didn't see Dallin exit her life, but she felt his absence immediately. She backed away from the balcony. Lana closed the door behind her. For a moment, Rhee felt as if feelings were birds, winging frantically in her chest. Julian was gone. Jocelyn was gone. Now Dallin, too. Would she always lose everyone who mattered?
I'm sorry, Lana said.
Rhee turned away, realizing that Lana had been watching her.
Did you love him?
Rhee asked. To fill the silence, to somehow feel closer to the boy who'd left. To pretend, maybe, that the question wasn't one she had often asked herself. Lana tilted her head.
I serve him.
She looked away, and Rhee saw her face soften for a brief, uncharacteristic moment. But she mastered it quickly.
Come, I'll escort you back to your room.
There was nothing more to say. So they took the long way back to the Emperor's quarters without exchanging a word. She would be meeting with Nero again soon to make their announcement. And Rhee would have to be prepared. She would have to steel herself for what was to come.
Chapter 10. Alyosha. Standing in the craft, packed in tight with a bunch of other fighters, Ali became a soldier again. But he wasn't the buttoned-up, uniformed soldier that he used to be, standing in neat little lines. No, yes, sir, or no, sir, or dropping to give the Sarge 50. He wasn't the puppet soldier either, smiling for the cameras on the revolutionary. That clueless kid with Bin by his side, cruising around as a poster boy for the Uniforce, while the world went to tahis around them. He became a Raitan again, too. Or, at least, he remembered he was. Spend too much time with only collusions, and you're liable to forget where you came from. Bury every memory of the Ray deep enough so that you never have to recall them. But now that he was surrounded by Raitans, he felt the tiniest fraction of ease. He heard the dialect he'd grown up speaking, saw it in the way they moved, the mannerisms of his ma and his dad, felt that hard front syllable accent reappear in the back of his throat when he talked. He let himself look like a Raitan, too, could see how his skin had gotten darker when he wasn't running for shade every time he went outside. His fingers got tangled in his hair. It went curly now that he wasn't keeping it cropped short to the scalp every week. Sometimes twice a week, just so the texture wouldn't show. He felt like himself in his own skin, felt at home, in a way he'd been missing for so, so long. Kara had felt like home once, too. He couldn't have shared the feeling with her, but he could have showed her who he was, who he could be. But then, he fucked it all up, and she died. He pushed the thought of her away, She was gone like everyone else he'd loved.
Just 2 days ago, he'd been holding Kara's hand. And now, here he was, part of the WFC's newest batch of freedom fighters.
What else was he going to do? Nothing and no one wanted him. And he felt the same about the world. The only thing he was hoping for was revenge. He'd go head to head with the Uniforce. You didn't get to use Ally and Vin and just get away with it.
This felt better. Felt right.
The current mission was to take back a massive satellite on Ustral, traditionally a sanctuary planet. Tucked behind a vast medical complex, the satellite and broadcast tower had been used for decades to beam out information about new medical techniques and technologies to far reaches of the galaxy. It could touch all the way to the outer belt, where often medical understanding was closer to magical thinking, and also to communicate with med bays that did relief work across the entire system. That is, until the Uniforce had assumed control of it, turning it into a machine to spew out war propaganda. The WFC was going to dismantle it, by any means necessary. They'd dropped into Ustral airspace now. He'd known a few Oosterlite soldiers back in the Uniforce, and he wondered now what they were up to. Was he dropping down on their homes right now, descending to light their southern hemisphere on fire? Distantly, Ally wondered about Jeth, too. After he'd helped them broadcast Ally's cube playback on Resto and taken them into custody, Ally hadn't seen him again. He didn't know what was up, whether Jeth was even alive. Pavel was practically fried. Ally had dropped him on the nearest WFC station for repairs, but he had no idea if he would make it. Vin was dead. Kara was dead.
"Secure the medical facility," said the commanding officer, pushing through the crowded ranks. "Once we have it, we can easily seize the tower."
A little thrill zipped through Ally as they all grunted in agreement. Ally prepared himself to drop, double-checking his parachute straps and adjusting his third eye. That wasn't the real name, though. Technically, the device was called an I-3, and it predated cube technology by about 30 years. They were going with old-style comm units that had a range of only 100 or so meters, since everyone had their cubes off. None of them had ever gone into battle without some sort of mechanism to connect instantaneously, and now they were going to do it old school. Ally was itching for action. He wanted to fight, blow things up, make people pay. The WFC had a firewall on all their crafts, but they'd all been additionally instructed to turn off their cubes before combat. And if they were caught or scanned, well, they couldn't get caught or scanned. It was rumored the Uniforce could hack their feeds even when the cubes were turned off, and Ally wondered if that's what the collusions were up to in those labs on the Zeppelin. Ally nodded at a nearby Fontizian woman, big and magnificent like a statue cut from marble. Her delicate pointed ears, almost comical in comparison. Ally pitied whomever she'd come up against. Then he nodded to his other side, at the stocky charum named Hesse, who reminded him of Jeff. Albino white flesh and shoulders as wide as the side of a barn.
"If anyone has taken from you or yours," the commanding officer said. "Justice shall be swift," the soldiers called back in unison.
It was the WFC oath, and Ally liked it. The ethos of doing something right, and doing it quick. The pilot was counting off to the drop.
"We go in 10, 9, 8.
The hatch opened slowly. The night rushed in to take them. They were pelted with fat raindrops. The wind screamed louder. Vincent should have been by his side. He'd cock his head at a moment like this, flash Ally his hollow star smile.
3, 2, 1.
The door fell away below him, and Ally was snatched into the darkness, somersaulting in sparks and stars and rain, with only a muffled silence in his ears and in his brain. Back on Rheta, before their civil war, His dad had saved for months to buy one crappy firework that they lit together on the anniversary of the day the Great War ended, watching it fly higher and higher until it exploded in a shower of light. For a split second, zooming to the earth, Allie wasn't a soldier. He was that firework from his childhood, but tumbling in reverse, a fiery symbol to celebrate a planet liberated. He hadn't counted. How many seconds had passed? His clothes whipped up around him. His mouth blew back in a grin as wind rushed down his throat. He'd done this before, but he'd had all the right gear and a drill sergeant riding his ass the whole way down. This wasn't a drill. Stabilize. He spread himself out in a star. The dark surface of the planet was rushing toward him, and he thought of everyone he'd lost waiting for him down there in the void. He could plunge into the outer surface of the planet, and he'd be lost too. They'd taught him in church that there was a place the dead went to be with Vadhan, an afterlife they'd all end up in, like it was a big eternal party with no fear and no pain. Allie wanted to believe that. He didn't want to think all the people he'd loved were gone. Not just that they were physically gone, but that their hopes and fears and feelings had dissolved like smoke until there was literally nothing left of them in the universe. The shield on his helmet registered the med center and the satellite tower, highlighting it in the distance. All around him, the blue LED lights flashed, and he had a close call with another soldier who torpedoed down, screaming at the top of her lungs, a battle cry. Allie felt all his organs clench up like a fist. The altitude readout on his shield said he was coming in close. Allie realized he was flying past floating blue lights. The other soldiers had already deployed their parachutes. He fumbled for the pull string and couldn't find it. He thought of Kara, the shitty things he'd said, the kinder things he should have said. The image of her limp wrist coming out of a sea of rubble, like she was trying to come up for air, but the only thing that had broken the surface was her hand. Allie clawed for his holster strap, still imagining the prayer beads tangled in Kara's fingers. Elegant, he'd thought once when he noticed her hands. How they looked like they belonged to an empress. Like they'd been taken care of. Like they flew across piano keys in grand sitting rooms within the palace. Let her go, he told himself. Allie calmed down, took a deep breath, tried slowly, less frantically this time. He groped behind him and finally felt it, trapped under the holster strap. He pulled the cord with his free hand, and the parachute released. The wind caught and rippled the parachute open. The silk dome bloomed above him, yanking him backward. His harness bucked, cutting into his shoulders. He swayed in the sky like the rest of the soldiers, all of them lit up like pieces of algae floating in the ocean. Vin had taken him to see the collusion sea once. It was last year, on leave. It felt like a lifetime ago. Now, Allie grabbed hold of the steering lines on either side. He focused on the target and got a sight line on where to land. According to the blueprints, the med center contained the only modes of direct access to the satellite tower itself. But Nero had put nearly 1,000 droids on patrol in and around the tower, a nearly insurmountable defense, unless all of them could be disabled. But the chances, with fewer than 40 green recruits and a handful of officers, were slim. Allie tugged on the lines of the parachute to steer, coming in hot, way faster than he wanted to. He tucked his knees up high near his chest. He needed to be ready to tuck and roll when he landed. Once his boots hit the soil, he felt the impact up through his bones. Rain fell from the sky and bounced back up off the surface. It was coming from everywhere. It was dripping behind the backs of his ears and running down his chin. He lost his footing and fell on his butt. In the distance, Allie could see the metal tower looming. The very top of it disappeared into the dark clouds above. Alpha Leader, I have visual on the tower, he said into his third eye. It was a flexible piece of metal that looped around his neck. He had to press a button and talk into the right side, and listen for a response from the other end. Nothing back but static. Great. The medical facility rose partway from the base. In his head, he heard the pilot saying their objective over and over again. Secure the medical facility. Take the tower. He'd landed right where he wanted, in front of the tunnel leading down into the waste corridors. There was, however, a droid guarding it. The droid was at least a full head taller than Allie. It stalked toward him, a red light scanning for him in the darkness. Allie pressed down on a handheld signal jammer that came with his WFC kit. Identification scan incomplete. The droid grabbed for Allie's neck, but he ducked and wove. I could use some help here, he called into the third eye, pressing the button frantically. It was useless. Pivoting his foot and shifting his weight, shadowboxing, scanning the thing for weaknesses or sensitive wires. It was a model he didn't recognize. And he regretted that in the Uniforce he'd never been taught to attack sophisticated army droids. Of course, back in the Uniforce, he and the droids were supposed to be on the same side. He jammed the heel of his hand straight into the droid's visual scanners, hoping to disable it. Then gave a modified uppercut right to an obvious control panel. A dizzying array of lights flashed across its module, and while it recalibrated, Allie pulled his knee high and brought his boot down hard on its steel knee. Rookie mistake in droid fighting 101. What would have hyperextended a man's knee just locked the droid's leg in place. It swept up Allie's foot in its tight grip and backhanded him. Allie spun and landed on his stomach in the mud. Pain shot through his ribs and he tasted blood. He scrambled, the ground slick with rain, toward a rock the size of his fist that lay a few feet out of reach. He heard the droid move into place, an executioner ready to bring down the axe. Extending his arm was excruciating. His elbow was on fire, broken or fractured for sure. His fingers just brushed the rock, and a sense of deja vu broke over him. He remembered losing his favorite wrench in the boiler room of the Revolutionary, straining for it, the day it all started. The day Crown Princess Rhiannon was supposedly assassinated. It was only days before Vin had died, killed by a Uniforce droid just like this one. His fingers closed around the rock. He spun on his back and launched the rock with less than a second to calculate trajectory. The rock cut straight through the air and nailed the droid's comm unit between its shoulder blades. It staggered on its feet, and Allie knew he'd hit his target. The gyroscope. The robo-droid's anatomy had been part of the WFC's crash course training. Its lights were going crazy. It stumbled in a half-circle like it was party drunk. He thought of a tree he'd seen cut down in the Ernu forest as a boy, and that breathless, weightless second just before it fell hard. Allie hooked the crook of his foot around the droid's ankle and yanked. It fell backward with a boom, boom. Allie climbed to his feet, wincing. He stomped down on the droid's head, just once, because he couldn't help but think of Pavel. Not all droids were war machines. Someone had made them this way. Allie flipped it over, grunting and straining the whole time as the droid flailed like a helpless insect. He gritted his teeth and ignored his elbow. Clicking on his flashlight, he wasn't sure what he was looking for until he found it. The outlet on the back of its neck. Right where someone's spinal cord would be. It was freaky how fully the makers had committed to human-like features. Allie ripped out its whole comm unit without any kind of plan. Only because he was exhausted. And pissed off. And in this exact moment, he hated this thing more than anything else in the universe. The comm unit was wet from the rain and glistened in his hand. It was sleek steel, cold metal, and it looked so different from his own cube with its tech embedded in roots. How it pulsed with life. He wondered what kind of secrets this cold, shiny comm unit had seen. What kind of data it held. And how he could use it. When Allie was programming Pavel, he'd inserted a sample of his own DNA into the server so that Pavel could better read and compare Allie's vitals. It was a standard technique, especially for droids used as basic companions. But could the process happen in reverse? He remembered Pavel saying that, theoretically, cube-to-cube transfers could be enhanced. That neural pathways could give and take info without even being prepped, whatever that meant. But what about droid-to-human transfers? He needed a doctor, preferably a cube surgeon. Good thing he was storming a hospital. He cradled his elbow and ran for the waste tunnel. Once inside the facility, he busted his way through three double doors to the main entranceway, where a dozen WFC soldiers were waiting to pile in. Allie didn't slow down for the others. He took off, running. Two other soldiers corkscrewed through the labyrinthine corridors behind him. Hesse, who'd been standing next to him on the way here, and an Oostralite who wore a digital tag that said Darris. Together, they burst through another set of doors into a waiting room. Dozens of stunned Oostralite patients looked up, completely unaware that a takeover was going down. Allie would let the others handle these folks. Following a slick of blood on the floor, he shoved his way into an operating room and surprised a doctor with a scalpel, carefully disposing of a used blade in a sterilization basin. "What is this?" the doctor demanded, taking a nervous step back. Darris's translation net relayed her words back in Raetan. But Allie didn't recognize the original language. He pointed his stunner at her with his bad arm. It felt like crushed glass grinding against itself at the joint as he extended it. She raised all six of her hands in surrender.
I've done nothing, she stuttered. What do you want?
I'm your next patient, Allie said. With his free hand, he threw the robo-droid's comm unit on the metal table where the doctor had laid her scalpels. They were knocked off the table, and Hesse had to dodge them.
Do you know how to enable this remotely? Allie asked.
He switched the stunner over to his good hand, and a new kind of pain, a stinging, pricking sensation, exploded in his elbow now that his arm was hanging loose. But he wasn't going to let anyone know how much everything hurt. He breathed through the pain. The doctor's hands fanned out in front of her, shaking as she accepted it.
How did you get it out?
I asked the questions, Allie said. The answer was obvious anyway. He'd ripped it out, and he figured the doctor was stalling. He still had the stunner pointed at her. Can you enable this remotely or not? Uniforce would for sure be on their asses by now, especially if the WFC's suspicions were right and they were tracking them even with their cubes off.
Yes, I can enable remotely, the doctor said. Just please don't hurt me.
Allie registered the fear in the doctor's eyes, and for a split second he felt bad about it. He'd always wanted to be the good guy, the hero, to rep Raeta right. Look where that had gotten him.
And you upload the information into my cube?
In theory, yes, but we're still in the early stages of research. Military droid data is encrypted differently. If I upload it to your cube, it may be detrimental to the human neural system.
Dumb it down, Doc, Allie said.
He looked between her and Darris, who had to translate everything on the fly.
I'm not a medic.
They code NX data differently. It may have dangerous effects on the organic matter connected to your cube. A portion of your actual brain could be corrupted, irreparably damaged.
Allie thought of the people he and Kara had found in the creepy lab on the Zeppelin. The vacant stares. The woman who kept drawing triangles, urgently, as if they meant anything. Still, they were running out of time, and they couldn't coordinate without cubes, without any kind of way to communicate across channels. They had to take over the tower. It meant he had to risk it. He figured maybe he was the only one with nothing to lose.
Figure it out, Allie said, pulling up a rolling stool. The droid will have info on how to hijack the tower.
The doctor frowned.
It's extremely dangerous.
Do it, Allie said.
With every second wasted, their mission had a greater chance of failing.
They needed the satellite. It was the key to Nero's spreading influence.
What are you doing, man?